A big welcome to you, Mats Lederhausen, founder and CEO of BCause, a curator and investor for companies with a purpose. More on that later. Firstly, we would like to get to know you and hear about your amazing life journey. So Mats, where are you in the world? I'm in an empty office in Stockholm, in Sweden. And where are you?
I am sitting right now in my home office in Chicago, downtown Chicago, in the United States of America, somewhere on planet Earth.
Yeah. Max, your family introduced McDonald's successfully to Sweden in the 70s, and you ended up working as a successful leader for McDonald's in the US. But in 2007, you decided to change direction and work with good investments. How did you end up where you are today?
I grew up in a very entrepreneurial home. My dad started a bunch of businesses. And eventually, as you mentioned, he started McDonald's in Sweden. It was the second McDonald's in Europe. First one was in Holland. And I was 10 years old. And on Kungsgatan in Stockholm, we opened the first restaurant. And that's how I grew up. It was a very family business kind of family. And I worked, you know, I kid that I was born in a French fry vat. You know, so I peeled potatoes and grilled flipped burgers and worked my way through, all the way through, you know, university, basically. I decided subsequently to go to business school. And then I got a job in London at Boston Consulting Group, which was great. Had my first child. And then I was called back to family duties when Sweden hit a pretty nasty recession in the beginning of the 90s. And I discovered then that a lot of people had a lot of opinions about McDonald's. I'm giving you the longer version. I'll try to make it short, but it's important for our rest of our conversation. There were a lot of people were angry with McDonald's, and I was, you know, this was pre-internet. It's important to say a lot of people can't relate to that concept. How did you find information about anything? But I talked to people. That's what you did. You interview them. You talk to Greenpeace. You talk to people that threw eggs at my face because they were really angry. And I tried to understand, how can you be so angry with hamburgers? I couldn't really understand it. But as I dug in deeper, and it has parallels to the world we live in now, I think, there was a like deep-seated anger and frustration with the status quo. And I think the predominant concern was around our ecological system at the time, and still to this day is, unfortunately. We haven't made so much progress. And it was manifested in, you know, I learned, and these were things I've never been taught. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know thermodynamics. I didn't know that, you know, the ecological system is actually a circular system, and we're running a linear economy inside a circular system. And for anybody that has any idea of physics, that won't work. Sooner or later, we're going to run into a wall. And the more I learned, the more I got concerned, and the more I shared their concern and frustration. What I didn't agree with, and I still don't agree with, is that the answer to all our problems is to shut down business or to close McDonald's, or to, it's all McDonald's fault. You know, I'm not one who seeks to blame. I want to figure out what the problem is, and I want to do something about it. That's all I'm about. And I looked myself in the mirror, which I think is the best place to look, and say, hang on, I'm the CEO of McDonald's in Sweden. We have 25 restaurants or 40 restaurants, whatever we had at the time. And I can do something about this. You know, I don't need to ask permission. I just can do something about this. Nobody's telling me I can't do anything about this. So we, together, a bunch of colleagues in Sweden, we set McDonald's Sweden on a path to a much more sustainable future. And we built a very progressive, modern enterprise version of McDonald's, which was very different. So we built, you know, almost 200 restaurants, and we got a lot of awards, and we built modern restaurants, and we ran our, you know, distribution trucks on French fry oil, and we got rid of plastics, and we worked a lot with the farmers, you know, LRF in Sweden, and we phased out antibiotics in feed, and we did a lot of really good things. I'm really proud of the work we did. And we also did really well. And it became clear to me that, why aren't more businesses leaning into social issues? Why isn't capitalism a force for good explicitly versus, in many ways, it is. I think most people that believe in business, and I'm certainly one of them, believe that a lot of businesses do a lot of good. I believe so. But it's not a stated intent. The stated intent of business is to make money. And that started really rubbing me the wrong way. And I ran into that challenge in many ways. And I was elected into something called the World Business Academy. And I was also elected eventually as a young leader of tomorrow at the World Business, World Economic Forum in Davos, where I got the chance to express some of these views. And it became clearer and clearer to me that this needs to change. We need to change and reframe capitalism. And at the same time, McDonald's started having real problems around the world. Some of the same issues that had angered Swedish progressives, and Sweden by and large is always 10, 15 years ahead of the rest of the world. They started manifest elsewhere, and they fired the CEO globally. And the new guy had been to Sweden several times and scratched his head and wondered, why are you doing so well? And we had explained why we're doing so well. So he was interested and asked me if I could come over and take on a big challenge to try to do this globally. And I did. So we moved over here in 1999. I stayed for about 4 years in that job. Then I managed to spin out a bunch of businesses we had acquired and ran that as a more of a venture fund for a few years, which I really liked. And then in 07, and now is the answer to your question, I had at that time spent about, I would say, 10, 15 years in the, I would say, talking business about changing capitalism. I had done my part at McDonald's, done as best as I can, and we can talk about more about that later. But I had been chairing something called Business for Social Responsibility, which is a large not-for-profit trying to do these kinds of things. I've been going to Davos. I've been giving thousands of speeches about why businesses should lean into this more. I'd given a sommarpratare in Sweden in 98. So I've been talking about this for a long time. And I just decided that it was fatiguing to argue with people that don't want to change. A man changed against his will is of the same opinion still, is an old saying. And I just think it's much more fun to work with people that actually want to do things than arguing with people that don't want to do them. And I think this is part of our problem in the world right now. We are stuck. And I think the people that are in power, by and large, don't want to change because this world serves them really well. Thank you. I said to myself, I'm getting older. I only have one life. I want to do what's fun. And I have more fun when I get to do things. So I said, I'm going to stop talking and I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. And I'm going to invest in companies that are born this way, that have a purpose bigger than their product, that want to change the world for the better and make money. Not one or the other, both. I'm greedy. I want to do both. And I only want to do it with people that I love. So I'm a very blessed, lucky man. I get to do that. I've done that now for, 13 years, and we have a portfolio now of, 50, 60 investments in two different platforms. One is this Because platform you see behind me, which is my own capital. And then I've raised money from others, friends and family and investors that like what we do, in a permanent venture capital fund called Cueball, which is based in Boston. And so I spend most of my time on those two investments platforms and having fun doing it. And we can talk more about how is it going, but that's what I'm doing. That's the long answer to your question.
What do you think are the biggest achievements from your McDonald's years?
From my McDonald's years? Well, I think it's probably the journey we all took basically between 1990 and 2000, those 10 years basically, in Sweden is probably the proudest achievement of my career. And not necessarily because we built a bunch of restaurants and we made a bunch of money and we made people, well off. And there's lots of individual success stories that I can talk to. People that started flipping burgers that now run, 28 restaurants of their own somewhere in Sweden, or 15 of them or 10 of them, and have done really well for their families and friends. That certainly is part of it. Ronald McDonald House, my mom started that with my dad. I had a sister who died in 1976, who is actually turning 60 on Friday, and I'm going to go to her. I'm actually flying to Sweden to go to her gravesite to celebrate her and her life. In their honor, we built, five Ronald McDonald Houses. We did a lot of things that I'm really, really proud of. But it's not even that. It's really the culture we created and the people and the vibe and the the lessons we all learned about leadership and the amount of time we spent together understanding ourselves and writing tombstones and understanding meditation and understanding our fears. And I get evidence daily to this day of how profound that work was. And it was really very special. And I'm really proud of that.
When you say that companies need a purpose that is bigger than the product, what do you mean by that?
Intention is everything in life. You know, it's like, what is your intention here? What are you going to do? I think the intention of a business must be to solve a human problem. It has to be. It can't be just to sell a product and then, you know, move on. That product has to have the intention of making life better in some manifest way. And there are basically two ways it can do it. It could do it one or the other way, or it could do it both ways, which is even better. One is that product or service itself makes life better for somebody. And I only invest in businesses that are hardwired that way. Like, they can't give up that mission. Then I'm out. Like, that's the main goal. And there's a famous shipbuilder outside Boston, which is world renowned for the quality of their ships. And they have a big stone outside their headquarters, which say, "We build ships of the highest quality at a loss if we must, at a profit if we can." And I think that should be the central theme of business. You should commit to a purpose, and that purpose is overriding everything else. You obviously need to make money, and you want to make money, and most of us want to make more money than less. That's great. But, you know, we've confused ends and means in capital. It can't become the reason for being. I need to breathe to live, but it's not my goal to wake up every day to breathe. So we've confused that, and it's not a semantic quibble, as I learned from my friend Charles Handy. It's actually a moral point. So the one way is through the product or service directly, but you can also have a purpose in how you do things. I mean, you could compete with anybody on, you know, selling glasses, you know, and your glasses might not be solving a human problem better than anybody else. They might not be better. They might be cheaper. They might be more expensive. They might, whatever. But the way you do it, and the culture you build, and maybe you only hire immigrants, or maybe you only hire ex-prison inmates, or maybe you develop your people because you're much more committed to your people, or maybe to your community, or maybe you're more sustainability oriented, so you have zero waste, or there's a way in how you do it that actually has a purpose in and of itself. I like most of my companies to do both. I like them to have a business in of itself that has a purpose, and then I like the how to have a purpose too.
Isn't it hard to choose who to support, who to invest in? What kind of companies do you have? What are the attributes they have? Do you have similar attributes, or do you just go on the gut feeling?
It's really hard to choose, and the one thing that makes me more optimistic than just about anything in today's world when I look at when I try to look for good things is the nature and the of startups today. I think more and more young people actually, they get this intuitively. They don't want to start a business that doesn't do anything good. They don't want to work for something that isn't anything good. So if I compare like just 10 years ago to today, the number of offers I get, the inbox, the leads of investment opportunity is just a factor of, I don't know, 100 higher, or maybe 1,000 higher, or maybe 10,000 higher. I don't know how, I haven't calculated, but it's unbelievable. So it is way more than I can handle. The good news is there's many, many, many more people that think like I think today, that have also raised a lot of money against it, than existed 10, 15 years ago. So that's great. That makes me very optimistic. And hopefully they're much smarter than me selecting. So I don't know. But I do it based on three criteria mainly. I look for three things. Everything I do is in threes. It's just easier that way. I can only remember three things.
Yeah,
I'm getting
exactly.
old.
Yeah.
I can't remember four. I need. There's something about three.
I think it's for everyone. Values is the same thing in companies. Only three. More you can't remember.
Right. Yeah. So the first thing is obviously purpose bigger than product. So what is the purpose? What purpose are they solving? And I look for big problems. I prefer bigger problems than smaller problems, but they don't have to be giant. And I think a misnomer in this category is that people, you're only credible if you sort of eradicate poverty in Africa, or if you solve the entire climate change problem, or if you, no one idea will solve all our problems. We have many problems, many, and every little thing helps. So I think there's a sort of big P and small P problems and purposes, and I look for both. But I'd like it to be a problem that is well understood, that is not new, that I can understand. So I don't invest in, biotech solutions or things that I don't understand. So it has to be things that I understand, maybe commonsensical things like weight loss and better eating and, better sleeping and better skin care. And, we can go through some examples if you want. But so the purpose is really, and I go well beyond just the problem. I look at, who is the person that came up with this idea? How committed are they? How did this happen? I look for a lot of signs there. Like, was this triggered by a crisis they had, which I like? Did they come to this authentically? Or is this an invented, I need to solve this problem because I want to start a business? That is not as attractive to me. There needs to be a real founding story that is credible. Secondly, people. You invest in people, you don't invest in businesses. Everything is about people. So I spend a lot of time both on the character and the quality of the people and whether they can actually do this. It's hard work to start businesses. Are they wired for this? What have they done in their past life that suggests they'll be successful? What are people saying? I do a lot of diligence around people. And thirdly, business model. I think that is really important. What I have learned and where I probably have made the most mistakes is that just because an idea is really good and needed, and just because people are really good and I really want to work with them, doesn't mean that their business model is a good one. And there's a lot to be learned there, but it has to have a business model, meaning it has to have identified a process that is repeatable, that yields customers on the other end, that buys their products and services, and that are willing to pay more for it than it cost us to deliver it.
So you mentioned some of the things that makes you invest in the companies. Is there anything, any attributes that would make you not helping a company? Did you even say no to, or do you say no to companies?
I say no all the time, and I say a lot more no than I say yes. But partly because I'm on 15 boards. I'm not a multi-billionaire. I don't have endless sources of time or capital. So I have to say no. I can't say yes to everything. And so I have to say no to a lot of things. I do frequently. I try to say no fast. I think fast no's are much more nice to people than stringing people along. And I also try to send people that I like having an idea that I want to see succeed in this world. I try to help them. So I help more people than I invest in. And I send them to other people that might be interested. So I try to be helpful, but yes, for sure, I say no a lot. And I say a lot, I hate saying no sometimes because there are some ideas that I really would like to invest in. I have several on my desk right now that I would love to put a lot of money into that I just, right now in COVID, I have, a lot of investments that I need to put more money into because otherwise they won't survive. So I have to make defensive investments in some of them, which I don't love to do, but I want to do it. So I want to be supportive. So, there's just limitations of time and money. That's why it forces you to say no.
If you meet a company who doesn't have a purpose for the company, that they have a great product, something, how can they find it?
I spend very little time with actually these days. I used to spend more time on that topic. I first of all, almost none of them come to me anymore. Having done this for so long and being so clear about what I believe, they don't show up at my doorstep anymore, which is beautiful. So I only get purposeful ideas in my inbox, really. And if I don't, I say no very quickly. Then it's a very fast no. And it's important to state this clearly. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean their idea isn't good. It doesn't certainly doesn't mean they won't make a lot of money. In fact, most people that make the most money, I think, generally have ideas that aren't that exciting for the world, which is sad. And I'd like to change that. Imagine if we lived in a world that the people that were the richest and made the most money also made the most contributions to this world by way of their business. How cool will that be? That's what we got to get. What's good for making money has to be good for the world. And in some cases, that is true in some cases. And there are edge cases, like we could debate forever whether, you know, Facebook has been bad or good for the world, whether Amazon is good or bad for the world. I think the answer is both. But then there are companies where I think, generally speaking, you know, it's easier to say that they're either good or bad. But so there, I don't spend a lot of time with people that haven't found their purpose. And how, you know, if your question is how do they find it, I'd say it has to start with the desire to find it. Are you looking?
We have a very good culture and we're a tech company and our product is very techy and it's a scheduling product and we love it and our customers love it, but sometimes maybe it's hard to actually find, I mean, the purpose is to make the scheduling process easier and more efficient for our customers so they get happy, but no one is really passionate about scheduling. You understand what I mean? So how do you kind of show the purpose in a good way?
Well, it's really important. Scheduling. I can only tell you it's really important. I can't tell you, at least not here today. You'll have to hire me and pay me a lot of money to do so, to excavate the deeper meaning of what scheduling means to people and how to articulate that and frame it in a way that excites and animates your organization. But that certainly can be done. There's this old famous story that I'm sure you've heard, but it's worth hearing again about these two, you know, it was John Carlson's famous story when he always told this when he was running SAS in Sweden in the whatever 80s. And he always told this story, and I always loved it. And it's that these two stone cutters, one guy has a little pile of stones next to him. He has a dirty uniform. He looks miserable, and he's cutting these stones. And the other guy has a huge pile next to him and looks really happy. And, you know, so when you see them, you go up and say, like, to the one guy, like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm cutting these stones. And he looks miserable, and, you know, he's just, his view is that he's cutting stones. And then you go to the other guy and say, what are you doing? I'm building a cathedral. You know, and that's the whole point. It's like you have to figure out in what way is your product and service of real deep meaning to humans. And I can only tell you that it really is important. I can also tell you that there is no one playbook for how to do it. It also has to be contextually correct with your culture, your current culture. It has to fit your story. It can't be retrofitted, which is why it often doesn't work, because your organization and your culture won't believe it. So Eric and the people that originally created this has to really embed this story, and you as a brand manager have to help them, you know, make it you know, sing and rock. But I can tell you it really matters, and done right it's beautiful. And I can also tell you that what you do for businesses and for people really matters, because a world without schedules would be chaotic, and it often is. So there is a deeper meaning there on trains running on time, that kind of concept that is really important. It sounds mundane, it sounds boring, but it isn't, because only when you don't have it, you realize how bad the world would be if we didn't have schedules. I mean, that's just an example.
Exactly. Mats, you have committed your life to proving that capitalism is a force for good. And how can it be in these times of environmental distraction from our overconsumption? Companies are dying because of this world crisis we're in at the moment. Isn't soft values and purpose the first thing to go out of the window when there's a lack of profitability?
We certainly live in a challenging time, there's no question. But let's start at the top. The fact is that despite what we're living through this minute, there's never been a better way to wake up as a human being on anywhere in this planet. It's an undeniable fact that we don't talk about enough. We've made enormous progress as a human race over the last hundreds and hundreds of years, measured in any conceivable way. Wars, deaths, famine, poverty, racial tolerance, you name it. I know it doesn't feel that way and it doesn't seem that way, but you have to look at the facts. Read Hans Rosling, our famous Swedish book. I forget the name of the book. Or Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now. There's just a lot of good books on it. I think Johan Norberg in Sweden has another good book out on it. Or, you know, listen to Yuval Harari, the famous Israeli historian, Sapiens and Homo Deus, and his great books. And he says this too. It's like, there's never been a better day to wake up as a human being. Our problem is it doesn't feel that way. So we have to start with a balanced perspective on our challenges. Now, we have plenty of challenges. And I think every generation has had plenty of challenges. We have, I would argue, predominantly, we have a climate change problem where we are not sufficiently understanding that planet has boundaries and we're treating it as it was infinite resources. And it's a major problem. It might be even too late to fix it completely. It's not too late to change course and limit the damages, but the damages might already happen. And we might see hundreds of millions of people having to move away from coastal areas of the world, which I think would be a tragedy beyond tragedies, and also obviously a human collapse intellectually that of maybe never seen proportions, because we knew this was going to happen. That's a giant problem, but it's still fixable. We can do something about it. And I'm doing what I can to do it. And so is our fellow Swedish Greta and lots of other smarter people than me. I think we have an inequity problem. The enormous progress that we have made while lifting the bottom people around the world from poverty, while producing a lot of life enhancement to lots of people, the progress has been too unevenly shared, in my humble opinion, which is causing a lot of pressure right now on the system, and it has to change, and it will change. So we have those are just two. I just picked on two problems, but we have many others. Healthcare, basically 97% of healthcare investment goes to treating downstream disease, when about over half the cost of healthcare is chronic management of diseases that are fully preventable. So it suggests that we should spend a lot more time preventing disease than treating them. So that's just another giant problem that I invest a lot of time and money into. There's a lot of problems, but I think it's very important that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't believe it. I'm not a Marxist. I don't believe that the answer to all our problems is to give the power to 9 people in Stockholm or Washington to make all the decisions for humanity. I think that's a really bad idea. We've tried that in many countries. It's always leads to complete torture and elimination of freedoms. I'm a market-based believer. A friend of mine once said, Mats, there's nothing wrong with capitalism. We just haven't tried it yet. To some extent, we haven't. We're hypocrites. If you think, basically what we've done is that we have privatized the rewards of capitalism and socialized the cost, which means that more and more people are bearing the burden and fewer people are getting the gain. And that has to change. And that's doable. We could price carbon. We could put a price on things we don't want. Tax bads, not goods. This is not impossible. In fact, it's not even that hard, I think. I think we make it harder than it should be. So I'm a long-term optimist. I'm a short-term pessimist. I think we have to go through some rough waters here. Certainly here in the United States, we're going through some really tough time. But I think nobody, I think Warren Buffett says this a lot, nobody ever got rich betting against humanity. I think you have to believe, and I certainly believe this, Anna, I really do, that there are more good people out there than there are bad ones by a wide margin. Like 99% of humans are really good, as far as I can tell. And we have free knowledge available to everybody in the whole planet. Those are two things that I will think the future is looking really bright. We have some challenges to sort out, but I'm convinced we will. Can I just add to that, that you know, we live in a very selected, biased world, which I think is a really big problem. You know, people watch what they want to watch when they want to watch it. It's algorithmically selected to fit what they like. They talk to people and they narrow cast in their own bubble, in their own social media channels, exactly the kind of things they either like or hate. And they are fed lies after lies after lies, or at least incomplete truths. And we lack a conversational climate right now where we can talk about the both aspects of any topic. We don't have a neutral media. We don't have a neutral academy anymore. And it's just a big problem. So you don't get truth. You don't get positive news. I mean, every day there's unbelievable acts of kindness. Every day, many, many, many more acts of kindness and love than there are acts of hatred. But the only things we are fed are the hatred ones. And it's like if you have kids, it's like I always liken this to, you would come home to your house and every day after work, you just focus on everything that was bad that day. You ask your kids, what's the worst thing that happened in school today? What did I mean, we don't behave that way, thank God. But that's how we live. That's our conversational climate is like that. And I think it's a form of pollution and a spiritual and brain pollution that is really unhealthy.
I read a quote from you that said, listening to customers and ultimately paying more attention to their needs than your own, you will be more successful. And this is so easy to say. Of course, every company wants to say that. But how do you really do it? Because it's really hard to cater for everyone. Like,
yeah, no, that's not a good idea. It's never a good idea to cater to everybody. If you try to be everything to everybody, you'll become nobody to nothing, or to everything. Empathy is a hard thing. You know, I posted in my newsletter last week a long newsletter on love and what empathy and love is about. And I also had another newsletter on empathy and sympathy and what the difference is. It's hard. It's hard to navigate. You know, I think Jack Welch said it the best many, many, many years ago in an annual report in GE. He said that bureaucracies love to focus inwards. It's not that they don't like customers. They just don't find them as interesting as themselves. And I think that is true. I think we all, particularly as you scale, it becomes, you know, your own inside process and internal processes becomes like all you care about. And it's really easy to forget why you did that in the first place. We establish rules, and the rules are originally designed to create a better outcome and experience for a customer, but then the rules becomes the customer. And I think that's very, very dangerous. And that's why a lot of companies die young, because they fail to adapt to a new reality. They fail to be customer-centric. I think Amazon is probably the best example. And I know Amazon isn't as big of a deal in Sweden for the Swedish audience, but Amazon is a big deal in America, a big deal. It's the highest value company in the world. And they have been amazingly successful. And I would say by and large, and we can debate the good, bad, and the ugly of some of their success, because every success has a backside of that coin. By and large, their main point of differentiation is that they are certainly more customer-centric than any organization I've ever run across. They are brutally, brutally customer-centric. To the tune, it's famous. Every meeting at Amazon, there's an empty chair, and it's the customer chair, and somebody takes on the responsibility to think about how would they react to this. And they look at that chair, and it's like, okay, well, we're about to make this change. Is that good for the customer? And I think, you know, being empathetic means you have to actually spend time with customers. You have to be out in their environment. I mean, one of the things we, I think, did well at McDonald's, at least in the back of the day, is that we were very, we lived with our customers. We were out in our restaurants all the time. And it's hard to not notice when customers are unhappy. But if you never see them, if you never talk to them, it's easy to be far apart and separated. So customer centricity is, you know, has to be the number priority, number one priority for any company. It just has to be.
The world is experiencing a joint crisis, and it affects all of us on so many different levels. How has this crisis affected you and your close ones personally?
In so many ways that I probably can't really yet understand. I think it's still in process. I think it has revealed and amplified structural problems in society that we knew, that I certainly knew about, that I had to some extent shaped my life to change. And it's been frustrating to witness the problems being more in your face. Inability to respond to the pandemic. I mean, we knew there were risks of pandemics. We've, you know, I listened to Bill Gates in 2015. I have a dear friend, Dr. Druckmann, who's talked about pandemics for years. I've read books about it. I mean, we knew that this was a probability. And I couldn't imagine how poorly prepared we were in terms of stockpiles of equipment to readiness to anything. I think it has revealed, particularly here in America, the disastrous state of our political system, which is in a historic low in terms of trust, ability, divisiveness, mean-spiritedness. And it's been really, really hard to watch and quite anxiety producing. I think the virus itself has revealed how difficult science is. I think it has produced both uncertainty in the global body of both politic and people about who can you trust, because a lot of smart people have very different opinions about this virus, you know, ranging from it's just a seasonal flu, it's not that bad, everybody's going to get it, most people won't die, we'll be fine, which is, you know, more or less the Swedish story, right? Not quite, but more or less, which, by the way, for the record, I am much more closer to believing in than the other side, the other extreme point, which is this is a really nasty virus. We don't know anything. We might not even get immune from having it. We're going to lock down the whole world in 3 years, you know. And somewhere in between, we know that the truth is somewhere between those extremes. We just don't know exactly where. And it's been really hard. The news is biased, the academy is biased, the WHO is politicized. So it's been really hard to watch all of this. It has also been a giant test of my own human ability to cope as a husband, father, grandfather, and business leader. You know, all those roles have been tested. And some days to its extreme. You know, I've been basically spending 24/7 in front of a Zoom camera with all my businesses trying to inspire them to, you know, I developed this frame in early March when I realized that this was happening. And I'm well connected, so I knew from Asia and I knew the stats. I knew kind of what was going to happen. And I knew that this will be a long haul. I knew this will take a year probably to sort out. It might take longer, but at the time in March, I thought, like, I got to survive to a year. So I went into, I developed this frame of extreme health, extreme cash, extreme leadership. And so the first thing was like, okay, what do we do to make sure that we behave as if, you know, people, all people are going to die from this. So like, we got to have extreme caution. So I run retail businesses. What do we do in protocols? What do we do with PPE? What do we do? Do we close them? Do we keep them open? What do we do if somebody has COVID? I was extremely involved in the health aspect of this. And I learned a lot. So I was never, and I'm still not very concerned about me. I'm predominantly very rarely concerned about me. I'm not that concerned about my wife. I'm not that concerned about my kids or grandkids from a COVID standpoint. I think they'll be fine. I am concerned about my father. I am concerned about my older relatives, my in-laws. So I've tried to display that and help them, you know. Then I went into extreme cash conservation. So I run private companies where I'm one of the investors in all of them, right? So, and I don't have endless money. How long is this going to last? How much money are they going to need? How do we make sure their money that they have in the bank lasts as long as it can? And how aggressive do we need to be to stop paying everything? So it's been a very difficult journey of lots of arguments with lawyers and landlords and, you know, like that. Not fun at all. And still not fun. Still in the midst of that. Still having nasty conversations with lots of people. And we try to pay as little as we can to everybody, including ourselves. You know, we've cut salaries. We've furloughed people. We've, you know, had to make really tough decisions to survive. So that's been really hard. And then the last point where I've spent most of my time, because fortunately I have management teams doing the first two more than I have to do. The last time has been more my job, which is how do I inspire all these organizations to look at this with a glass half full mentality? What's good about this? Where is this, you know, we call it, where's the silver lining in the dark cloud? This is clearly a dark cloud for humanity. There's just no question. You don't have to debate it. This is not good. But where is the silver lining? Where can we find, you know, how can we, as they say here, how can you make lemonade out of lemons? So I've spent a lot of time on that. Like where, so in all my companies, we've launched pretty aggressive innovation agendas, aggressive rebranding platforms, you know, turn into digital business where they didn't have enough, et cetera, et cetera. So that has been, you know, what has got me through this, to see the spirit of people and how much we've gotten done with fewer people, and the fighting spirit in all these businesses have gotten me, has been what has kept me eager to wake up every morning. But I must tell you, it's been really hard. We had our youngest daughter got married this Sunday, which was, you know, mixed feelings. You know, it was beautiful, loved them, loved the event, loved everything about it, except the fact that it wasn't what we had planned, and it was, you know, all the people I love weren't there. It's like that's what we're all living through now. It's not perfect. But let's put it all out there and let's just commit humanly, all of us, to just make a better world out of this, because it's about time. Let's fire all the people that have got us here and like just start anew, put some new people in place and start building the world we all deserve. Because I'm a human optimist. I think we can build a much better world. And there's been really good things about this, like this. Like you and I might not have had this conversation, and certainly not at the quality we're having it. I've learned a lot of having these conversations. I'm going to travel a lot less in the future, and that's a good thing. I'm going to still travel. I'm still going to meet people. But I'm going to think really hard before I jump on a plane to LA for a two-hour meeting. You know, why would I do that? So education is being reframed. A lot of things are being reframed. Telemedicine. There's a lot of things we're going to be much more productive as a human race, you know, in a couple of years based on all this. It was a time machine. COVID has been a time machine. It has accelerated all the things that needed to be accelerated. Lastly, I really, really hope, this is my biggest passion, I think, is I really hope people will take their own health a little bit more seriously, because they don't. Not judging from what they eat and how they move and how they behave and how they think and how they sleep.
Or stress.
Huh?
Or stress.
Or stress exactly.
Yeah.
We gotta take our daily habits really seriously. And we haven't. And if we did, we would have all survived COVID with much greater ease.
Thank you so much, Mats. It was amazing to have you here. It was very interesting. I learned so much. Thank you.